What if I gave you a way to 3x, 5x, 10x your fundraising this year? Starting this month, I'm opening up my Fundraising Accelerator program to coach you to be the fearless, effective fundraiser that your organization needs you to be. In this accelerator, you'll work with me in a small cohort for 7 weeks starting in February to organize and laser focus your fundraising efforts for results. The cohort is limited to 20 participants, so apply today at rheawong.com. That's rheawong.com. Because your nonprofit isn't here to just survive, it's here to thrive. Again, that's rheawong.com to apply today. Welcome to Nonprofit Lowdown. I'm your host, Rhea Wong. Hi, podcast listeners. Today we are talking with Jay Frost, who is an expert fundraiser and board manager. So Jay, welcome to the show.
Hi there. It's great to be here. And I might introduce myself a little differently. I'm not sure I would be a board manager so much as a professional observer in this world of fundraising, but happy to talk about this. It's really important stuff. Thank you so much for inviting me to hang out with you guys today.
Such a pleasure. So Jay, you have your own firm now, Frost & Fundraising, which is great. You all should check it out. But tell us a little bit about your long career in philanthropy and fundraising.
Sure. So my long career in fundraising, wow, that's a graying moment. Not long ago, someone told me one of these private conversations that I had become a gray beard and I'm lacking the beard. But anyway, I think you get the idea of the metaphor that when you've been in any business for long enough, people start to think that you have wisdom that you probably don't. I fall into that category. So I started in the field as a grant maker. I was very lucky when I stumbled in my first real job to work for the National Endowment for the Arts. And that was a framing moment for everything I do. So it'll probably come back up in the conversation later. So even though it was only a couple of years of my life, it was a 24-year-old with some measure of responsibility for a couple million dollars in grants to artists. And most importantly, maybe to this conversation and for a lot of my work and maybe yours, it's understanding what I know, but mostly what I don't know, and trying to learn from others and then help them to be the better versions themselves, if I can, in some small measure. But what it meant to the 24-year-old, just to go back to that, was that I was exposed to people with a colossal experience who sometimes were deferential to a person they couldn't see on the other end of a phone. It was quite a moment. It's not like the moment we're having together. You can see me and I can see you for the most part. Anyway, it was a great way to begin a career that started as a grant maker, worked my way into fundraising, working on a capital campaign initially for an international institution, then doing international fundraising there in DC, then going into services for a part of the company, which is now known as Thomson Reuters, working in the development of what is now commonly known as wealth screening. Then leaving that, going back to the world of fundraising for International Rescue Committee in New York, doing major gifts. And then returning when they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, it really was like the mafia, to take over the division, then spin it out of the company, and later selling it to another company that maybe some of you know called Wealth Engine. So I was there, eventually left that role and started doing consulting. And today do a combination of consulting under the Frost on Fundraising banner, but also with other firms, Visionary Philanthropic, Gerald Panis Lindsay and Partners, and Brian Lacey and Partners out of Texas, as well as helping the folks at Donor Search in doing a little bit of what you are doing, which is to host programs, facilitate conversations, and see if we can bring some heat and light to the world of fundraising and philanthropy.
Thanks, Jay. So let's bring some heat and light and get right into it. So let's talk about boards and major gift fundraising. So the number one complaint that I hear from folks in the field, and certainly my clients, is that my board is not involved, engaged, or interested in fundraising. What are some of the top reasons why?
This is the hardest question, and I'm glad you're starting there. What are some of the reasons why? I think that you go from person to person, they're going to give you a different answer. I wonder if part of this is definitional, that often we will try to recruit people for reasons we think they're going to add something to the board. Sometimes those reasons are well-founded, sometimes they're not. But then we don't necessarily define well what we're asking them to do. And that's very hard for people. I mean, just think about any of us in our various roles in our careers. Whether you operate as a soloist or you're part of a company or somebody within an organization or you're a board member, if you don't really know what you're there to do, it might take you a while to acclimate and to do whatever that thing is well. But there are different personality types at play here. So some people just go ahead and put the pedal to the metal and make things happen. But if there's no definition, are they making the right things happen? Or do they just become a huge problem for the culture? And by the way, I don't think it's their fault. I think, again, it might be helpful if we just gave people a map and some road signs, and we told them what the speed limit is. That's not to say that we can't have some people who drive a little faster or who take us in new directions, because board members should ultimately be strategists, not workers, in a successful, mature board. But I do think it would be helpful to give them some rules of the road as we understand it today, and to make sure that those are the kind of people we're really looking for, that B, they know what they're getting into, and C, we give them a way to get it done effectively. And oftentimes, we don't do those things at all. So I keep running into situations with boards where I'll ask them if they had a job description and they say no, or they don't remember seeing one. Or I'll ask if they've had a board training and the people on the staff say, we did that. And I'll ask the board members and they'll say, I don't remember doing that. I don't remember is the most terrifying answer you ever get, because it means it didn't have the impact you intended it to have. So even if you did your damnedest to make sure it worked for them, if they're not retaining that, they're not making it part of their practice, something has gone amiss. So again, I think that much of this is definitional. The more we can not put in these definitions to restrain ourselves, but to give us some kind of glide path together, then we can work to broaden the road. But if we don't start with that, we're just all wandering around the field.
So let me break that down a little bit, because you are absolutely singing from the same playbook as I have been talking about, which is, number one, we're not clear with our board members. Before that, we're not even clear about who we're recruiting and why. Then once we get them on the board, we're not clear with them what the expectation is or what we want them to do. Then once they're on, we're not providing training to actually building their skill sets in any meaningful way. And then we end up just complaining about it to other executive directors and behind the scenes.
Is this your experience too?
It is my experience. I think as executives and as leaders, we under-communicate all of the time. And so there's this disconnect between what I think I said and what people actually heard and what I intended to say and what actually landed, right? And so understanding that there is a gap there, and the gap can be smaller or bigger depending on who it is and how they communicate. But I think the number one complaint I hear, certainly things I've heard with board members, is like, I was recruited because they thought I was an expert in X, Y, and Z, and now all they're talking about is fundraising. So tell me a little bit about that, like how you think about a mix of board members, and do you think that all board members, regardless of capacity, should be involved in fundraising?
Those are two potentially different things, I think, and both very important. So recruiting people for, what are you looking for in a board member, and then can all board members fundraise? So answering the second one first, and I hope this doesn't sound too flip, I think the answer is yes, as long as we understand what fundraising is. And I see a lot of resistance, maybe you do too, to the idea that anybody can raise money. But if what we are effectively doing is inviting other people to participate in the thing that matters to us, because we think it also matters to them, that's fundraising. And so it's less about the asking than it is about building the relationship. That isn't to say that we don't need to ask. We do need to make the invitation to give, and it needs to be clear and specific in order for it to be effective. But if it's all about the ask, then that's going to be a failure no matter what the person's skill set is. In fact, do you mind if I peel it back and think about the staff for a moment?
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, there's a tendency, especially with organizations as they're growing, to say, well, let's go out to the corporate sector and get this person who's got this great skill set, like sales, and bring them in, or marketing and bring them in. And those are two different things too, right? So, and that's fine. I mean, I'm all about learning from others and bringing those skills to bear when people share the same passion and purpose. But if we're just, like you said, identifying just a skill set and thinking, oh, it's like the old invisible man, you know, it's just another layer on the body. So this one's the tissue and this one's the musculature and this one's the butt. It's not like that. You can't necessarily transfer sales skills from one thing to another, for profit to nonprofit, in the same way that you can't transfer sales skills necessarily from selling software to selling bananas. I mean, those two things are different products. And if the person's really passionate about bananas and they're the best salesperson in the world for whatever, Chiquita, it doesn't mean they're suddenly going to be great at selling etherware. And I think that happens a lot with boards too. Here's a person who's got a skill set. We think, well, if we bring him in, we're going to solve this problem. I don't think that's fair necessarily to ourselves and especially to the board member. So what is it that can help with that? I wonder if maybe one of the things that we can do is not only, you know, create those job descriptions that allow for the right mix of people to come in, but if we can stop thinking about the board members necessarily as worker bees, but instead people who are, again, committed to the same purpose and are willing to commit themselves wholeheartedly to it, including through giving. So I know we haven't talked about that yet, but that's the perennial, right? Are you going to be a supporter of give, get, or get off, to use that crude phrase? But I believe in that wholeheartedly. If we are inviting people to serve, the first thing we want to know is not whether or not they're an expert in, for example, behavioral health or performing arts in the Midwest or, you know, running a community hospital. Those things are good to know. But the most important thing is whether or not they feel at the core of their being that this purpose is essential and that they will support it with their whole heart. If they're not willing to do that and to do it at the level which is possible for them, then they probably shouldn't be serving. And no matter what their skill set, they won't be able to be a convincing solicitor. On the other hand, if they have none of those skills, and we've seen this a lot with historically with spouses, but definitely with people across all professions and age groups, backgrounds, ethnicities, language groups, native origins, then anybody can be a powerful and effective solicitor. If we just let them tell their own testimony, it reverberates or resonates with the person they're speaking with, and then they make the invitation, having heard that person first, to participate in the same activity. So I think the first thing is passion.
And I love the terminology that you're using. You don't say ask, you say invite them to participate. And I think that using the phrase really changes the way that we think about it. I want to talk about the four-letter F word for a second, fear. I think board members are really afraid of asking for money. We've on this podcast covered the question of baggage about money. I think we all have baggage about money. So talk to me about the extent to which we as executives need to help our board members face their fear of asking and fear of rejection head on.
Man, and fear underlies all these things, right? I mean, one of the other conversations is about how we select these board members to make sure that it's reflective of the whole community. And there's fear about talking about race. Or if it's something about gender, there's fear about talking about that because we're all walking on eggshells, but we better address gender with the diversity in our boards and all these things. So yeah, fear is huge. And fear of fundraising is the same kind of thing. So how can we get people beyond the fear? Well, hopefully part of that's in the recruitment process. So we have to talk to them pretty specifically about what they're going to do. So they don't end up there and then suddenly say, oh, you got me here for fundraising. It's what you said earlier. But at another level, isn't it also helping them get through that training process that you alluded to, so they really get comfortable with telling a story, but maybe more importantly, learning how to listen. And I know that that may be a lot to expect. We can't do a survey and say, oh, that person's a good listener, so we should bring them on our board. But if we are careful about how we're making our selections, then hopefully we can also look for people who really listen well. And then when we're training them, one of the primary things we'll do to train them, because they'll be people with hopefully extraordinary skills and passion already, is to make sure that they also are attuned to listening to others. And if they can do that effectively and then be able to repeat what they've heard in the same way that I think all good listeners, like you're doing, if we can do that, then they'll find more success. So a lot of the training that I do with boards now boils down to some very high-level stuff, which can seem kind of boilerplate, but it's also to get them talking. So I can repeat what I've heard, including the fears, so they can hear their own fears and get past them. This question of fear is really a big deal. And I love it that you talked about it in the context of how we all have this strange relationship with money. And we do in this country. You know, we're talking about money, sex, religion, and politics. These are all crazy landmines, but we live them every day. And these board members have to be our partners. It can't be people who just show up once a month or once a quarter on the phone. If we're going to really make something happen, first of all, it's more about the money. And for that to happen, it has to be that true partnership. So we have to be in a position where we can talk. So maybe we need to draw them out. So one of the things I do with boards when I do retreats, for example, is a pre-board meeting survey to ask them a lot of questions, which the organization should already know the answers to, but often does not. And then I use that as a way to then show them that I've heard them in the meeting. And then I ask some even more intimate questions in the meeting in everyone's presence. So sometimes I'm doing it that way, and sometimes I'm getting them to write something to say it out loud. Any kind of device which gets them to talk about the things that are most important to them, but they're most fearful about discussing. And if we do that respectfully, I think we are giving them a gift. Because a lot of my work, as you know, and maybe others don't, is sitting down with people when we could do that, about 48 inches apart, and just asking them questions and listening to them. And so feasibility studies and things like that. But that's all major gift work. And where I see the link between that and working with the board members and getting them to confront fear is giving people permission to talk about who they truly are through the lens of what brought them to that table. And the most revealing conversations I've had in the context of these board meetings has been about, why are you here in the first place? I'm talking a lot, but I'll give you one tiny example, is that I worked with a group of occupational therapists on a board meeting at one point. And that room could have been pretty dry because of what they're talking about. But people started revealing why they were sitting at that table and told stories they had never told those other people in several years of sitting on that board, including about how one person got into the field because when her mother became ill and infirm, and she had to go up to see her mother and it was a walk-up, like a second or third story, her mother, once she became unable to traverse those stairs and didn't have an elevator, was stuck in her apartment for the rest of her life. Her life effectively to the outside world was closed off. And so for her, getting to this field and then finally joining this board was a way of ensuring that no one would ever experience what her mother did. Yeah. And she had never told that story to her fellow board members. And so one of the small things that I can do when I work as a consultant is get people to open up about what they truly fear and their greatest hope.
And Jay, you know, what you're talking about is something I've been thinking about for a long time, which is that I think we as executives don't spend the necessary time to knit these relationships together. Because if we don't know each other, we don't like each other. If we don't like each other, we don't trust each other. If we don't trust each other, we can't work as a team towards a common goal, right? And so often, I think as executives, we may have individual relationships with board members, but we forget that board members don't have relationships with each other outside of the board meetings.
Boy, do I agree.
And so anything I think that we can do to your point around helping them to really reveal who they are and what they care about and what purpose they have on the board and how that purpose aligns to the work of the organization means that you're going to have engaged board members.
You know, sometimes it can have unintended consequences though. So one time I was with the Humane Society and I asked them about the names of their first pets, which turned out to be a very emotional moment. And I didn't even ask, and they started telling stories about their first pets and how their pets had died and things like that. And these were people in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and they're talking about a pet they had when they were six. It was a big deal. But it was funny because they started mentioning pets' names, and then I realized halfway through, they were also revealing passwords. So I had to ask them to change the passwords by the end of the meeting because they had no idea what they were doing. So have to be careful what you ask for.
So let me ask a more of a tactical question. Where do you stand on the idea of every board member has to give a personally meaningful contribution? And I say that because I have this conversation all of the time, which is there are certain people that we don't ask for money for whatever reason. It may be my personal opinion. Well, I have a personal opinion. I'd be curious about yours.
Okay, well, that's not fair. But then I'm going to have to ask you to reiterate yours.
Well, it's my show. So there you go.
Well, I'll play by your rules. My feeling is 100% that everybody serving on a board should give what is a personally meaningful gift. But even that phraseology, we play around with these words because we're trying to find the best way of communicating that idea. So another thing that I worked with Jerry Panas, who had wrote 22 books on philanthropy and all this stuff, and he taught a lot of us. And one of the things he would say was, he would describe it this way, that it has to be their greatest philanthropic commitment. So for one person, it might be $50, but for another person, it might be $50 million. But this had to be their primary philanthropic commitment. You know, now some people serve on several boards. My first reaction to that is, that's wonderful. They're being generous with their time, but how committed are they? Because we can be polyamorous in a sense, I guess, with our board memberships. But all of us understand the limitation of that kind of love in life, just as in board service. So I would like to think that people should make what they're doing right here their most important commitment, if for no other reason, because then when they go and they talk to other people and they ask them to participate, they first listen. So first of all, they're listening to an intimate story to help people give, to invite them to give. If they're going to do that, they had better be equally committed. If you're asking somebody to start revealing the story of their life and you have not revealed yours, you have not made that level of commitment, what are you doing? So yes, everybody must give. And I have to say something else. There's a big debate right now in the field about donor-centric fundraising versus community-centric fundraising, which I think is a very important discussion, but I think it's being held for many of the wrong reasons. I believe those two things must be like this, and they aren't. So there's no reason why every board can't be reflective, not just of the community they're in, but really the community as a whole. So first of all, I'm completely committed to that and revisiting what our definition of diversity is as we look at those things. So we don't end up picking people for their ethnicity in the same way that you talk about picking people for their skill set. That's insulting to them. It's insulting to the community. We're looking for a way to make sure that every voice is heard, every voice is represented, and we can do it. And by the way, when we do it, that doesn't mean that we don't ask them to give. In fact, not asking someone to give because we think they're too poor, they're too young, they're too whatever, I think is an insult to that person. We all know from our work that volunteers can be our best donors. Why is that? Because they're committed. And if they can't give a lot today, they might be able to do something substantial, at least for themselves, but probably for us tomorrow. And we can all tell 100 stories about that. But throughout my whole career so far, the people sometimes that we don't think of as our greatest potential in terms of resource development, but also the greatest people for in terms of their love and commitment, are sometimes these volunteers that we never, never truly appreciate and show our affection for. Let's ask everyone to give. And if, by the way, if they're not willing, they shouldn't be serving. There's need to be space for somebody who will.
Yeah. I happen to agree with you 100%. And it's an interesting conversation that I have with executive directors. And interestingly, I feel like I have this conversation with a lot of founders who are really reluctant to ask, especially legacy board members, to give. And which I find interesting. But one of my mentors is writing a book right now, but she has talked about the act of fundraising is actually a spiritual act.
Yeah.
And that I think philanthropy is a spiritual act and is a way in which we make manifest our values and what we care about. And at the end of the day, money is a resource that can be replenished. Time cannot be. And so if I'm spending my time with an organization, that is far more valuable than the money. So the money is easy because I've already given you the hard thing, which is my time.
Yeah. In fact, I wonder if it's Melinda Gates or if it's the head of the foundation who talks about that with Bill Gates about why does he do what he does? Is that a personality characteristic? Is it a part of his, you know, whatever it is? It's time. It's recognition that we've only got so much time. And I think everyone knows that, but that's another thing we are fearful about talking about. We see that manifest in discussions about planned giving, whether it's at the staff level or at the board level. But I think all of that is because we know that tomorrow could be it. If we didn't feel that all before, we certainly have felt that since March 12th. And we have to provide an opportunity for people to give the investment themselves they truly can, because tomorrow it'll be gone. That's why I'm so passionate about this stuff with boards, because if they're willing to serve at all, then why would we not ask them to do the optimal of what they could do? Because they're going to rotate off the board soon. And someday they're going to pass away. The time that they spent with us is their one opportunity to invest themselves in some cause that was meaningful to them. If this isn't really their thing, we should free them from that obligation. If this is their thing, we should give them every tool so they can affect the change they want to see in the world before they die. It's an obligation.
That is absolutely what I think. One last question before I open up. I know there are lots of hot questions out there, but what is your perspective about term limits?
Yeah, I'm kind of mixed on that for the same reason I am in politics. With the founders, you know, it's so interesting when you mention that. I'm thinking about one organization I worked with where that was really an issue. The founder was brilliant, brought on some brilliant people on the board, so they would have been the legacy board members. And one organization was not giving at all. And I pushed and pushed and pushed until a point where I'm surprised he was keeping me around, talking to him about the CEO about this. But he just was adamant. He told me he won't give. I'm not going to ask him to give. I suggested rotate him off the board. He said, no, I won't do it. He has too many connections, all this stuff. I don't think it was about any of that. I think it was about his personal connection to this person and the way we were showing respect to the person. But I think it was corrosive to the environment as a whole. Even if people never talked about it, we all know what this is like. People can smell it when people don't give. It's just something we know. It's visceral. So I do believe with respect to term limits, the reason why term limits can be effective is because it gets rid of that problem in part. If people are unwilling to commit at whatever level, whether it's giving or asking or committing their time or contacts or doing the work, the term limits help us to make those transitions in a friendly manner. But I wonder if maybe sort of like politics, if we might apply those to organizations, staff as well. Where I've seen some of the biggest issues have been with founders of organizations, fortunately none I've worked with, but others in the field, some of which we know and have great respect for, where they've just been in that role too long. I think that all of us benefit from learning new things and having new experiences. And I don't know how you affect term limits on staff, but I think it's about time we apply them there as much as we do with the boards.
Jay, we are going to have another webinar about that because I have opinions about that. You were absolutely right, especially when it comes to founders. There can be, you know, a reluctance to have a conversation about what the next leader might be.
It's hard.
It is really hard. Put a pin in that to come. That's another hot and juicy conversation.
We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors. What if I gave you a way to 3X, 5X, 10X your fundraising this year? Starting this month, I'm opening up my Fundraising Accelerator program to coach you to be the fearless, effective fundraiser that your organization needs you to be. In this accelerator, you'll work with me in a small cohort for 7 weeks starting in February to organize and laser focus your fundraising efforts for results. The cohort is limited to 20 participants, so apply today at rheawong.com. That's rheawong.com. Because your nonprofit isn't here to just survive, it's here to thrive. Again, that's rheawong.com to apply today. And now back to our show. In the meantime, I'm going to call a vote. So Jenny, do you want to ask your question?
Sure. Hi, Jay. This is super helpful. Love all these questions. Constantly thinking about all of this as executive director. So we're creating our first fundraising committee. We have 14 board members. They all give. Some fundraise, many don't. And so we're creating this committee. We want to be sure this committee doesn't replace the responsibility of the whole board to help open doors and networks and things. And we're making this a staff-led committee, so they're helping us and not spending all their time talking about a gala we don't want to have, as opposed to governance committee, which is board-led. And so my question really is, what are your words of wisdom to make sure that this committee is successful and engaged and helps serve the organization and is also fun for them? Because we know that many board members might choose to be on other committees rather than this one.
Yeah, let's talk about fun first, because I'm all about the fun. And so I think it's great that you're talking about that, and great to hear your colleague on the board too, and the role of the social aspect of the board service. And by that, I don't mean the parties you don't want to have, but an opportunity for people to get to know each other, like we were talking about a second ago. I think it's vital that people have that camaraderie, that we develop that so people can be effective and they can bring that energy back to the meetings instead of what's going to happen? Am I going to be expected to have done something? Oh, this is a pain. It's this, you know, chore, Sisyphean feat. So in fact, I was just looking at this board source report, the Legacy with Intent report, which is something they produce every 2 years in preparation for this meeting today. And I didn't take down notes about it, but they talked a lot about the social aspect of effective boards, which I find to be true. And it sounds like you're making a part of your practice too. So first of all, I applaud that. I also want to applaud the fact that you're having a staff component. So when you said staff-led, I don't know what that means exactly, but I think the idea of staff partnering with board members to make things happen is very, very smart. One group that I did, this was a small project, but it was with a very large organization. It was when I owned a screening company. We had run about 1.6 million records. And so we had a tremendous amount of data, but they didn't really know what to do with it. So they had me do a board retreat where we talked about asking for gifts with the foundation board. And one of the things we implemented was, first of all, a plan. So there was something written, the definitions. And then secondly, staff partnering. So that each person would get a small list, 10 names, I think it was per quarter, but it could have been then accelerated with time, with success. And there was a staff partnering. So there was information on who they were going to talk to, right? And these were all effectively development committee members, but it was a foundation board. So they were all serving that capacity. And the staff member would be kind of working with and coaching, but also learning from the board member. So they were supplied information, the prospect was qualified. And then the next question was, what are we going to do? And it was always partnership between the staff member and the board member. Now, was it always effective? No, because sometimes the chemistry there, you know, you have to work on it. And sometimes it's not always there. But it was great to support the board member so they could do what they do best. And they weren't expected to do research on Google about who they were going to see or develop a strategy in isolation about what's going to work or try to figure out what might happen. You know, what's our best case scenario and worst case scenario on a solicitation? So all of that could be staff-led, if you want to use that phrase. So I think that's very smart. And then the third piece goes back to what you started with, which is the idea that you don't want to take the responsibility of participating in inviting people to give from the whole board. I completely agree with that too. The development committee should, I would think, act as the locus point for your development work within the volunteer corps and to act as an example for all fundraising for the organization as a whole and an example to the community about why it's important to give. So it's the place where the rock hits the pond and that flash starts and the ripples go out from there. It's not the end, it's the beginning. So if the development committee effectively is saying, it's the booster squad, look what we're going to do. This is a goal we've established. Isn't that exciting? We've all given already, and we all have a list of whatever it is. Our five people we're going to talk to this month, our goal towards the big event this year, hopefully not, but maybe, all those things that we're going to do, and they can bring that enthusiasm and joy and mainly energy to the whole, I think that's very good. So that's not very wise, but I just wanted to make sure that I recognized and applauded things that you're doing that I think work really well, and especially your sentiment that it cannot stop there, that the rest of the board has to see the development committee is going to be the moonshot for the rest of the board. It's not the entire NASA program. They're just a part of the whole.
Thank you.
Actually, to follow up on that question, Jay, so one thing that I hear a lot from executive directors is like, certainly the charge of the board is to provide access to networks. And I hear, I've asked my board to introduce me to people and they won't come up with any names. So can you talk to me a little bit about how you have encouraged board members to open their networks and provide potential prospect names?
Besides asking them?
Yeah, that's well, hard. If you ask and they don't do, what do you do? I mean, give a cattle prod in the back? Like, what's happening?
No, actually torturing board members, I would never recommend that. I just don't think it works. Tried it? No, I haven't. So there are some technical things we can do. You know, I've been involved in data for a lot of my life. So one thing you can do is you can put a list in front of them of people you're pretty sure they'll know. That's old school, right? So when I got involved in fundraising, it was pure screening, which means for those who don't do this, that you'd have a whole list of people, you'd get several people in a room, like a corporate committee, for example, and then you'd have them look at the list and they'd say whether or not they knew them and then what they knew about them, you know, with just a sentence or two, so it's not exhausting. And then whether or not they'd be willing to reach out to them. So you might be able to get person A to take this list of 10 people and person B to do that. What you're really doing, though, is mapping the connections between people. So that's an old school approach, but you can then use 21st century tech to get a little closer to that, whether it's going directly through your CRM, not giving access to your board members, no, but issuing a report from it that show the relationship map between people, maybe using a tool like RelSci to help map that out, or an industry cross-reference tool and some of the screening products to do that, or if you need to go and do something particularly new, and this is not a great way of doing it, but you can do it. Let's say you go and you look at the person's Twitter account and see who's following them and look for the people with the biggest follower accounts and find out to whom they're connected. So there are half a dozen ways you can do this that are traditional or new, that give them a list and then let them say, not just do they know them, but hey, yeah, I haven't talked to that person for a while. I can do that.
Yeah. And Holly had a very good idea too, which is to use LinkedIn. My favorite thing is the second degree search function on LinkedIn.
Yeah, absolutely. I mentioned Twitter just because sometimes Twitter talks to passion in ways that LinkedIn does not, but I'm a big believer in LinkedIn too. There are so many things we could talk about on the marketing side, but that's not today's purpose. But the social platforms are a great way to find out what people really care about and who they care about if we look at them correctly. And there are increasingly some tools available to mine that data, but we can talk about that another day.
Okay, so I know a question came in from Suzanne earlier. Suzanne, do you want to ask your question about new technologies on the topic of technology?
Sure. Hi. I really appreciate your comments. I am the director of development at a small legal rights sort of organization in California. Our board is all lawyers. It's very little diversity, and they're all quite senior, which makes sense since we serve seniors. But I found in trying to organize a fundraiser that there was a very steep learning curve with new technology. This year, I tried to organize our very first peer-to-peer fundraiser and did everything I could to sort of make it as turnkey as possible, and found a lot of resistance from the board about kind of creating a fundraiser page and helping with the fundraiser. And we only did it with the board. It was our first one. We thought we'd start with the board. We'd build out to volunteers and staff later on. And I was honestly very disappointed. And I just wanted to know if you have any insight or advice on how to kind of bring people along who are very kind of opposed to trying new things.
Wow. There's so much embedded in that. It's almost like our discussion before about talking about money or other things we don't generally talk about. And I'm from Connecticut, so there are a lot of things I don't talk about. I grew up in a very puritanical kind of world. I'm trying to think about that. I think I'm going to tell you something, or I'm going to respond in a way that isn't surprising, which is that I think we have to meet people where they are. And unfortunately, it's very individualized. But I suspect the problem is not usually tech itself. The reason I say that is probably most of us have a family member who's in their 80s or 90s who is using something. They may not be on TikTok, but they're on something and they can surprise us. But getting them interested, that's the harder question. And I wonder what the impediment is for each of these people. Is it time? Is it doing something new, change? Is it feeling like they're going to fail, confidence? Is it thinking, why are they asking that of me when I have this other skill that I have not been able to use? You know, kind of that sentiment, which I think is common for all of us, right? As volunteers, it's hard to know how to answer that. But I do think it's possible to get almost anyone excited about the possibilities of technological solutions to problems that we have, whether in making the analogies to things that they've already had to do, not as a way of convincing them, but acclimating them. So the oldest traditional example would be, we've all done laundry historically, unfortunately, in the past, much of it done by women. And then we have washing machines. And same thing with dishes and dishwashers. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that those things made our lives easier, because we all know that's not true. We found other ways to waste our time. But we do understand how we move from having to push clothes in a bucket into putting some clothes in something and walking away for an hour. And I do think that people have that touchstone already with the analogy of something like Facebook, where people can say, you remember what it was like before the pandemic? We just pick up the phone or talk to somebody. So many families now are having Zoom calls, and the first ones with many family members are so painful. I still look up my elder sister's nose on every phone call. I don't know how I'm going to get over that. But it is important to make the analogy, I think, to things that people understand and already utilize, and then maybe help them to get closer, not just to what we want from them, but what they want from themselves with their activity with our board. So if we've done a good job, I think, not only of saying this is what we need in a board member and recruiting thusly, and then also finding out what that person thinks they can really contribute and make sure that the things that do fit best are utilized fully, then maybe we can attach the technology to those things rather than to our needs to their needs, which is another way of saying I tend to focus on the donor, or in this case, the board member, find out who they are, what they're about, what they want to accomplish, and then always use tech as a way of helping them to accomplish it. So it's a very long answer to a simple, but I think enormously profound question.
So I have an interesting question coming in from Margaret, and I think this sort of speaks to the question of, you know, give, get, or get off. So Margaret?
So the question I was wondering about is, just to give an overview, sure. I'm the executive director for a founding board. We've never had an alumni before for a medical school. So all my alumni are doctors. They have, because we're a medical school and we're needing things for our students, that in addition to, I mean, of course, we all need money for things, but in addition to funds, we also need access. Mm. So I have board members who have provided access to allow our students to like go to the front of a long waiting line to get your kind of rotation at a hospital that they couldn't have gotten otherwise, versus other board members who have made financial contributions. And arguably, they're both valuable. They're both providing things that we need. And so I've struggled a little bit with like, okay, you're doing this. And I would say everybody has contributed in a small way, if not a personally meaningful way, to like smaller projects. So we have 100% you know, everyone is giving. I just wonder, how do we quantify those gifts that are sort of service related, just as important, I would say, to our school?
If I could understand your question, it's how do you look at the valuable contributions of a board other than money?
Exactly.
One of the things that occurs to me as you talk about that is, it sounds like you are making sure to acknowledge the importance of those kinds of contributions.
Right.
And to feature them before the rest of the board and hopefully the organization and maybe the community. I think all those things are really important. And it strikes me that, and this is a simplistic response, but there's a tendency for many organizations to talk about their achievements rather than the achievements or contributions of their community, meaning their donors and their board members and volunteers. But when we do that, when we put a face to the not just the revenue, but the activity of these people, I think it makes it real, tangible, and appealing to many others who would emulate it. So as you talked about this access to a program like that, first thing I thought was, well, because I don't work in the world of medicine much, and I work with a few hospitals, but not like you do. I wonder if maybe one of the issues of access is first having a model for it, which a person like that has clearly provided. You know, here's one way that we've been able to do something, show that it's successful. So there's less reticence to introduce that kind of model in other places, the pushback they might encounter back, economic pushback, time, we're busy as doctors already. Every doctor in this country right now is nuts working their tails off. So anything that makes it more palatable, more understandable, more better defined, and celebrated, I would think would be very helpful. And if there's any kind of debate about whether or not that should be celebrated, I hope that that will change. I have to say one other thing about this, especially with respect to medicine. I hate prejudices of any kind about anything. It's just kind of a natural, I'm naturally repelled, but we're all victims of some form of bias, and I have them every day. I recognize them every day. In fundraising, one of those things that we hear about a lot has to do with lawyers and doctors, which we've just been talking about, right? People always say, oh, those people don't give. And I think it's nonsense. Right. It's total nonsense. It's unfair. One of the things I like about what you said is, first of all, if you showcase that there are different ways that people can contribute, I think it will bring other people to the table. But I think it does one other thing, which it dispels this notion that somehow doctors and lawyers are all rich people who don't care about it. And I know that that's a huge statement, but I do think it would be helpful to dispel that notion, but also act as an economic driver. But there's probably a lot of other stuff that we could talk about for a long time here, baked into what is the profile of the members or donors or supporters or constituents within your organization? What is the value they derive from it? How is that similar to or dissimilar to what they have from other organizations to which they belong? Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're developing a model that first of all makes it possible for people to say what's possible. And that also allows you to maybe pierce that blood-brain barrier, that natural barrier that forms around these cohorts. That's something that people do to protect themselves. And doctors and lawyers, again, have to protect themselves. So do rich people. And so anything we can do to make it so we can get past that and be comfortable and friendly and show them things can work and that we celebrate them when they do, I think is really, really wonderful.
So as a follow-up to that, Jay, I'm just wondering, is the access that Margaret is talking about, is that a substitute for a personally meaningful gift?
I don't think so.
A last question coming in from Lauren.
Hi, everyone. So my question is, if a board member, if their gift comes solely from their company or corporation, there's a fund and they're able to donate to us, but they never personally give any money from their own sort of account. Do you think that that qualifies as a personal, meaningful contribution?
No, unfortunately, I don't. Again, gotta love these people, but that's not why they are there. They're not there because the company. Companies are not people. That's expressing my politics. So I apologize for being so direct about it. But that doesn't mean I hate companies. I love them. And most of us are involved with one form or another, but they are not people. And we're looking for contributions from people. That even includes, by the way, if we went and talked to a company, we're talking through a person about what are the needs and interests of the company and its shareholders and stakeholders. I really think it's all about people fundamentally. And so I think it's great that they are helping to facilitate that gift. But maybe if they could be made to better understand that if they personally made a gift, it would help to elevate everybody else's giving, that it would act as an example for others to reach out to companies, that would be great. There's one other thing that's just a technical aspect, and it may not relate to your situation. It may relate to others who give to you. I would encourage everybody to look at matching gifts as just a generalized strategy that we typically don't do very well. And there are lots of companies like Double the Donation or HEP, you know, Educational Development, others that will be able to identify all the people who are with companies that can match gifts. If you have people who are insiders at companies or directors and officers at that level with public companies, they can often give at a much higher level. So let's say you have a person who says, well, I give through the company. You might say, well, that's great. But have you thought about at the end of the year, if you decided to make a personal contribution, it could also be matched by the company. So if you give us $500, that's a $1,000 gift. I think encouraging people to think about their giving as not just an individual act, but as a lever for other giving to support the things that they love is probably a good idea and strategy with respect to every donor.
Okay, well, we have to wrap it up. But one last question for me, Jay, as we look ahead to 2021 and the overall fundraising landscape, obviously you don't have a crystal ball. But what are some trends that you think that we should be aware of, particularly as it pertains to how we're thinking about engaging our board?
If we are able to get comfortable with starting to talk to people like we're all talking together and then first listen to them through these platforms, and then come back to them with proposals for support when they've expressed an interest, then I think we've addressed one big hurdle, but we have not addressed the other big one. And I'm afraid that it's going to be buried in all the other things that we're concerned about, whether it's the coronavirus or the economic challenges that we're having. And that is the diversification of our donor base. We could talk about it with respect to boards, but I think it's a broader issue. And the one of the stats that I pulled just in advance of this, because I find it so stunning, is that as of the 2017 report from BoardSource, only 27% of all organizations have no people of color on the board. 90% of CEOs and board chairs are white. 84% of board members are white. While women are increasingly at the helm of organizations in the staff level, board chairs remain largely male, almost 60%. And this isn't to say that not all people have a role to play. They do. And a lot of our donors are going to be white guys like me. I'm not saying throw them out. I'm just saying there's a role for everybody. There should be space for everyone. And if you thought about this and you didn't care about these issues, and all you cared about was the money, and all of us are much bigger than that, but if all you cared about was the money, the reality is the biggest cohort is under 40, probably under 30 now, but is largely ethnically diverse and is economically driven by women. If we do not get to know these people, they will either build their organizations of their own instead of giving to us, or they will give through mechanisms where we can't do any stewardship, like Facebook fundraisers or other things that prevent us from building relationships. And I think that these things are contributing to this collapse of the donor colony, where we've seen 70% of the population in the United States gave through formal channels in 20 years ago, and now it's 55%. We have an opportunity here with respect to engaging the whole population that we saw between April and maybe the end of the summer, to talk to people where they are about the things that matter to them, and to invite them to participate in this discussion in a real, authentic, and substantial way. Or we can continue to do what we've done historically as nonprofits, which is just to maybe invite people to speak at a conference or have one board member who represents some particular community. That's not enough anymore. Because even if all we cared about was the money is in the hands of people who don't look like the boards of the past. So I hope that one thing we'll do in 2021 is to start thinking, what is it that my kids would like this organization to do in the future? What is it that my kids would like to see in the mission that we pursue, and who are the people driving that mission? If we think that way, I think we're going to naturally find we have more voices here, not just among board members, but also among donors. And it's going to make it more sustainable and, frankly, a lot more interesting and fun.
Jay, thank you so much. This was so informative. Where can folks find you on the interwebs?
Unfortunately, too easily. So you can just throw a stone and hit me out there. But probably the most easily would be either on frostonfundraising.com, or you can look for me on LinkedIn, which is just Jay Frost. I don't think there's any other Jay Frost who does fundraising there. Or you can follow me on Twitter if you'd like that sort of thing. I'm at Gordon J. Frost. So you can just, that's my entire panel.
Wonderful. Well, we will make sure to post all your info in the show notes for folks who want to get in touch with you. In the meantime, thank you so much, Jay. This was super informative. And I hope you have a great week, everyone. Take care.
Take care, everybody.